Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to welcome to the Salieri Report a man who needs no introduction, of course, on the Salieri Report, John Rappaport. I got very frustrated the other week about some of the media attention and sort of the big lies on Ebola, so I thought it was imperative that we get him on. John has done enormous amounts of very deep investigative reporting for many decades on this topic, and in my opinion, there's nobody better on the planet. So, John, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Great to be here. Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, I appreciate your covering what's been going on with Ebola, because you have been, you know, that's the advantage of having very deep history on this stuff. You can jump out there and just start to tear those lies apart like a pit bull. But why don't we step back a little bit and talk about pandemics, the history of pandemics, and how it was you got so interested in the subject and developed such an extraordinary amount of knowledge about this.
Okay. Let's see. This would have been 1986, 87. I was a freelance reporter. I was doing a lot of stories for LA Weekly. And I had just done a crazy story about the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and various groups that were trying to attack it and destroy the Dome of the Rock, which was a Muslim monument, thereby starting a, you know, global conflagration. And it was just all kinds of crazy stuff. And so after that story was published by the Weekly, I thought to myself, well, what could be stranger than that? And the word AIDS popped up in my mind, and I thought to myself, yeah, I'm sure there's something really bizarre going on here. I knew nothing about it. I had done some research on pharmaceuticals, toxic pharmaceuticals, but nothing about germs and nothing certainly about pandemics. So I started to look into this, and I met a guy in Los Angeles where I was living who introduced me to a small publisher who said that he wanted to do a book on AIDS from the perspective of natural health. And I said, well, I don't know about that angle in particular, but I would certainly dive into the subject and, you know, write what I come up with. And we made a deal on a contract, and I jumped in. It was my first book, AIDS, Inc., Scandal of the Century, as it was later titled. And so for the first 4 or 5 months, I was interviewing all kinds of people about AIDS and HIV. And these were people, some of them from conventional medical research facilities, and then there were alternative types. Everybody had a pet theory. Everybody had, you know, this is really what's going on type information, and they were all in total conflict with each other. So it started to drive me a little bit bats. At the time, this was before, you know, I even thought about having a computer. I was still working on a typewriter. And I had these notes in my studio taped up on the walls. And by the time, you know, 4, 5, 6 months went by, the walls were just covered with these various notes of, don't forget this, and this guy said that. In those days, a reporter like me could actually talk with researchers, AIDS researchers at universities and even at the CDC and the National Institutes of Health.
Yeah, a lot of people weren't scared yet.
Yeah, that's way different now.
Right.
It's impossible. So finally, I read an article by Dr. Peter Duisberg, who was a molecular biologist at the University of California at Berkeley. This was a paper published in a journal in the spring of 1987, Cancer Research, a well-known journal, and he basically said that it was very unlikely that HIV was the cause of AIDS. And he gave various reasons for this. And so I took off from that and I began to talk to other people who weren't bound by convention. And pretty soon I was convinced that by the rules of conventional disease research, germ research, nobody had ever proved that HIV caused AIDS, which began to put into perspective everything that I had been confronted with up to that point. In other words, the various so-called risk groups around the planet, gay men, Africans, Haitians, IV drug users, hemophiliacs, the common denominator was that their immune systems were all blasted away, because that's what AIDS was supposed to be. It was supposed to be a syndrome in which immune systems were destroyed by a germ, and then various infections that would come along that ordinarily wouldn't cause any harm would kill these people. And I thought to myself, well, if HIV has not really been proved to cause AIDS, then I should be able to go into these various risk groups and find other reasons that have nothing to do with a virus that are destroying their immune systems. And lo and behold, I was able to do that after a few months of research. I could find all these reasons why people were dying in these groups. And then I was introduced to various rules of how medical researchers decide that a germ causes a disease, called Koch postulates. They had never been satisfied in the case of HIV, not even close. In fact, animal testing was involved, and there were 175 chimps at various research facilities around the United States who had been injected with HIV. And I spoke with a man who was in charge of monitoring all of that, and he confirmed to me that after several years, none of these chimps had developed AIDS, which made Koch postulates even more remote. I mean, there was just no way that you could assume that HIV had been proved to cause AIDS. And then along came a Nobel Prize winner, Carrie Mullis, who said that he had been searching in vain for a single research paper published in a journal that proved HIV caused AIDS. He couldn't find one. And he had spoken to some top-line researchers who had either brushed him off or said they would send him the article, and they never did. So I was more convinced than ever that this was a gigantic hoax. I mean, the biggest story that I had ever covered, certainly up to that point by far.
Let me just interrupt, because one of the challenges, you know, AIDS is one of these stories where the official reality is so far from the facts that it's almost too hard to fathom. You know, it's like mortgage collateral fraud. The fraud is so enormous that no one can fathom that it's really true.
Right. Which goes along with, you know, the old slogan about, you know, people will believe the biggest lie. If you want them to believe a lie, you've got to make it bigger and bigger and bigger. And this is what had happened. And of course, there was no way to really get much of a hold on publishing articles in media for me on this subject. I did publish a couple in alternative newspapers. So, you know, I was going with my book and I kept on researching it, and I got in touch with a publisher who was a medical doctor, and I told him what was happening, and he said, great, just keep going, keep going, keep going, and I did. And eventually the book came out. In addition to that, I have to say that I interviewed people who had been diagnosed with HIV and who had rejected the diagnosis because they too had come to the conclusion that HIV was not the cause of AIDS. And so they took the diagnosis as a sign that maybe they should do some reflection on their own general health and take, you know, normal steps to improving their health, and that was about it. Better diet, exercise, nutritional supplementation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these people were not only surviving after an HIV diagnosis, not taking any of the drugs, which, you know, all the medical experts said was a sure sign that they would die, but they were thriving. They were in tremendous health. So the book was published, and we did some press on it, and I did some radio shows. And curiously enough, I really didn't receive a lot of attacks because I just made my case. And I said, look, what's more important, returning people to health or arguing about the politics of a virus? I don't care about the politics of the virus as far as health is concerned. I certainly care about the politics because it's part of the story. But, you know, for example, in the case of gay men, many gay men were afraid that if the virus, HIV, was taken off the table as the cause of AIDS, everything would go back to the time when they were being blamed for spreading this global pandemic that was going to kill everybody. And so my reply was, that has nothing to do with what I'm doing. Do you want to get better and become healthy? Or do you want to stick to a certain kind of political fear that could kill you? It's, you know, it's not my choice. I'm just providing information, and that's that. And people became interested. I mean, the book has remained interesting to people. It was published in 1988. Lots of people were interested at the time. Lots of people are interested now. I still get emails about it. And so this kind of gave me my background on so-called epidemics. I should also say in addition that when I discovered the risk factors for destruction of the immune system in these various risk groups, for example, let's take Africa, it was clear to me that what was being called AIDS over there was really basically what had been killing people for decades and even centuries in Africa. Starvation, protein calorie malnutrition, hunger, contaminated water supplies, overcrowding, lack of basic sanitation, land that was stolen, agricultural land stolen by local dictators and foreign corporations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that somehow the research papers that were written about AIDS in Africa were entirely slanted to pretend that this was something completely new that had never been seen before. And it was a kind of vast cover-up. I had a conversation, the cover-up, I should say, was in the same sense that Ebola is now. If you've got local dictators, fascist local governments working in collusion with mega corporations, financiers, globalists, you name it, in order to steal and drain the resources of a country and make trillions for other people, you want to keep the local population under control. You want to keep them weak, debilitated. If you can even arrange depopulation, you want to do that because you want to make these countries into basically just, you know, places where invaders can come in and rip up everything and control the situation completely. If you now say that the entire cause of illness, debilitation, death, and dying in that particular country, like, say, Uganda, is HIV, you've got a brilliant cover story, if it's believed, and it has been believed. It's a political cover story, and the medical cartel has convinced many, many people all around the world, professionals, lay people, for a long time that germs are terrifying and to be feared. And so you've got a built-in audience and a built-in propaganda campaign, and it works perfectly, which is the case. So I guess, you know, I could talk about this subject for, you know, 3 days without stopping, but one anecdote. Near the end of my research on the book, actually, I think it was just after the book was published, a doctor from Washington, D.C. called me, medical doctor. I didn't know who this guy was. And he said, well, I've heard about your book. I've read some of it, et cetera, et cetera. He said, I've got a kind of conundrum. I started a small clinic. I think it was in Uganda. Very small, clean, good facilities, clean water, food. A few AIDS patients, handful of AIDS patients. He said, so eventually we decided we were going to grow soy, just a small amount, because these people needed protein. And they could also make a little money because we could sell, some of the beans. He said, well, after these people were there for several months, I don't know exactly how long, but at least several months, and this, they were growing the soy, they were getting clean, nutritious food, the water was clean, it was safe there, it wasn't overcrowded, et cetera, et cetera. He said, these AIDS patients of mine have lost all their symptoms. I said, yeah, so? He said, well, I don't know what drugs to give them now. Wow. I mean, you know, that was, I wish I had taped the call. I mean, that was an historic moment for me. It was like a perfect thing.
Okay, can I match?
Seeing the cure in front of his eyes.
Right.
But he was conventional, and he couldn't, you know, he couldn't make it all jive and come together, because with his training, he still believed that HIV had to be the killer and he had to give these people drugs. And I said, well, you know, I can't answer that question, but, you know, why do you want to bother giving them drugs? Don't you think they're in good shape now? And, you know, he just wasn't sure. He just
wasn't. It's too, you know, the truth can be overwhelming. I want to share with you one of my magical moments. I had my father's mother died in the Spanish influenza in, when was it, 1917? It was before World War. Was it after World War?
Right at the end there.
Right at the end of World War I. And in fact, 675,000 people died in the United States, Spanish influenza. And I was in Bolivar, Tennessee. So it was about 10 miles from where I live. I was in the county seat. And I was shopping at the grocery store, and there was a gentleman who was in his 70s who helped me to the car. He was helping people with their bags. And he said to me, you know, are you going to take the flu shot? And I said, no, I never take vaccines, ever. And he looked at me, his eyes twinkling, and he said, neither do I. He said, you know, the only people who died during the Spanish influenza were the ones who took the vaccine. He said, those were the only people who died. He said, it's old-timey knowledge. We know around here not to take those. And, you know, which brought up the question, because I think the big issue for many of us is, you know, do we run the risk of biowarfare?
Yeah, I can talk about that. Actually, there was a book written, I wish I could remember the name of it now, by a person who was elderly and had been through that exact period of time, 1917, 1918. And she also wrote, she said, in my community, you could tell the people who were healthy and the people who died. They were the people who either took the vaccine, and I believe it was actually the vaccine for yellow fever, because that was widely distributed to troops and other people.
Mm-hmm.
They died, and the people who didn't take the vaccine didn't get sick. So here's what I discovered about vaccines. First of all, whether or not they contain, quote, biowarfare elements they're toxic. So, for example, you go into a country, let's say a country in Africa or South America, or you go to a place in America where the people are poor, the nutrition is very bad, there's extreme poverty, people are sick, they're eating junk food diets, that's all they can afford, et cetera, et cetera. You give those people vaccines and you run a tremendous risk because the vaccines will push their already compromised immune systems over the edge. And they will get, many of them, very sick, and some will die. That's just your standard, ordinary vaccines that contain germs that are intentionally placed in there because that's the vaccine theory. You give the person a little bit of a germ, and that prevents the real thing later on. And then in the manufacturing process, quite often other germs will get into the vaccine. So you've got that. Then you've got all the chemicals in the shot that are standard, like formaldehyde, in some cases heavy metals like aluminum and mercury, and then other chemicals that are toxic, especially when you inject them, because anything that you inject into the body bypasses the normal channels of immune defense, many of those channels, because you're directly injecting it into the body. It's not something a person eats or they get on their skin. The body has many layers of immune defense. Bypassing that through an injection, now you're doubling down. You're adding a great deal more risk to the situation. So whether or not we're talking intentional biowarfare or chemical warfare by adding in covertly certain elements to vaccines, all by themselves, they pose a risk and a danger, even to healthy people, because, as I just said, you are bypassing the normal channels of immune defense. So in Africa, in fact, there was two grand vaccine campaigns before the announcement of AIDS, and they were the smallpox vaccine campaign and the polio vaccine campaign. In 1976 or so, the World Health Organization popped the corks on the champagne and announced that they had wiped out polio in the Third World, in Africa. Well, a friend of mine who is a geneticist told me off the record, very hush-hush, that after the smallpox campaign in Africa, there was a secret meeting of the World Health Organization in Geneva. This would have been late 1970s, at which it was decided that they would never use that vaccine again. Why? Because it was so dangerous and because it was causing cases of smallpox. So the idea that they actually wiped out smallpox, to me, is a gigantic hoax. They could have derailed some of the visible symptoms of smallpox, in which case other symptoms visibly would show up in people and they would call those by other disease names. But the problem was not eradicated. In fact, it was exacerbated. And the same could be said to be true of the polio vaccine campaign. And we're now seeing a resurgence of polio in Africa. So these campaigns all by themselves, added to all the factors that I mentioned about, you know, contaminated water, et cetera, starvation, hunger, now you really can cause massive numbers of people that are ill, debilitated, and dying. So people have to keep that in mind. I'm not suggesting that we have to apply Occam's razor here, but you don't need to invoke the idea of intentional biowarfare to show that vaccines are highly destructive.
Right. Let me jump forward, because one of the things that got me so focused on this in the late 90s, we started to see a process which has continued of very highly credentialed scientists dying mysteriously, many of whom were microbiologists. I don't know if you're familiar with the list on Steve Quayle's website where he just keeps running totals of the death count of scientists mysteriously being murdered or killed or disappearing.
Right. I'm familiar with some of the names, yeah.
But there was there was one period when there was a noticeable number of microbiologists. And it made me very nervous about, you know, I watched in Washington on the financial side where people suddenly went quiet and got afraid to talk because they saw what was happening to people who were just doing their job and being honest, being targeted and subject to all sorts of, you know, including physical violence. And clearly something similar was going on in the scientific community that would have lots of scientists, you know, scared. And I know there's a wonderful documentary we did on the Solaria Report, Bertram Verhaagh's Scientists Under Attack, about the kind of force and violence that's been used against scientists who tried to tell the truth about genetically modified food. So, you know, as you said, we're in an environment where now scientists are much more, find it much more dangerous to talk freely and openly. And of course, that detracts from getting good information and having an intelligent debate. Can we fast forward to the swine flu?
I just want to make one comment about.
Please do.
Biologists, and that is, I can't, you know, absolutely say this is why they were all killed. But in the case of these various kind of fake pandemics that people have seen come down the pipeline, where, you know, it's mass hysteria, and then when it's the dust clears, well, we had, you know, 1,100 deaths around the world, the CDC will say, or the World Health Organization will say, and then they'll suddenly inflate the figure and say, no, it was actually millions, you know, I mean, just insane stuff, and I could document that I have. The process, and for example, we're talking West Nile, SARS, bird flu, swine flu. Those would be, you know, the big ones. There was also the threat of a smallpox terrorist attack in the U.S. that never, you know, took hold. You've always got a small number of researchers suddenly, as soon as, you know, it's announced SARS, perfect example, 10 labs that were hooked by closed internet, private, worked on finding, quote, the cause of SARS when it was announced suddenly. And they came up in rapid time with this thing they call the coronavirus. And, of course, I was immediately suspicious after all my work on HIV. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. You know, the normal course of science is that somebody says, okay, I found the cause of a disease, and this is it. Here's a photograph, electron microscope. Here are the characteristics. And then you have other scientists who are not connected in other labs who replicate the same research and see what they come up with. But, of course, this is no longer the way it's done. 10 labs, private, secret. Cause announced. While I was starting to write about this, one of the microbiologists connected with the World Health Organization, Frank Plummer, up in Canada, said, you know, it's strange with SARS because we're looking at people who have been diagnosed with SARS, and fewer of them seem to have this coronavirus in their body. And he kept on lowering the percentage of these patients that actually had the virus, which was supposed to be the cause, until finally he was saying that it was approaching zero. So that's kind of like saying, you know, we know what the cause is, but nobody that's got the disease has the cause. It was pure insanity. And I think that some of these microbiologists cottoned on to this kind of thing with some of these epidemics and actually weighed into the research and looked at it and said, this is insane. These people are cooking this up. It's a hoax. This is not science. They're doing something else. They're promoting, you know, pharmaceutical companies, drugs, vaccines, whatever they are. They're trying to scare people. They're, you know, whatever the microbiologists might think, they would say, this is not science. And they would begin to maybe talk to a few of their colleagues, which is what scientists do. And the word would get out. So-and-so thinks that, you know, did you hear what he said about SARS? He said it's a total hoax. Well, this guy's walking in danger land. He doesn't know it, but he is, because there's a lot riding on these epidemics, fake epidemics. So anyway, yes, we can fast forward to swine flu.
I just want to mention, because, well, I guess it comes up with swine flu, because I discovered Cheryl Atkinson through your, I think it's pronounced Atkinson.
Yeah.
Atkinson. And she was a very terrific reporter, investigative reporter at CBS, who nailed the CDC on lying over swine flu. And you did a couple of interviews with her on your website, which are really terrific. But anyway, so let's come forward to swine flu, because swine flu is one that really got under my skin pretty early. So I decided to write a commentary on the blog that said, you know, I think this is, you know, whatever this is, it's either a complete lie or it's depopulation, but they're trying to give you a shot. And whatever you want to do, you don't want to take the shot.
Yeah, away you go. Don't get the shot. Right.
Right. Don't get the shot. And you know, I got terrible criticism. I mean, unbelievable criticism, you know, as a conspiracy theorist and all this kind of stuff. But what was interesting is there were a whole bunch of us, and you were certainly one of them, who jumped in early and said, this is a lie, this is a bunch of bunk, and this vaccine stinks. And, you know, I think Gary Nell got a whole bunch of professionals who brought lawsuits, and there was really tremendous pushback, and they had to back down. I don't know if you remember, I think Massachusetts passed a mandatory vaccine law, you know, and they're trying to get the states to push mandated vaccine laws, and the pushback was enormous. And of course it got, you know, it got killed, but, you were left.
That was major, you know, because this was the first so-called epidemic where the internet was really cooking. So they couldn't stop people from publishing, you know, not only of blogs and so forth, but, you know, actual findings that were contrary to what the authorities were saying. And I remember it well, because I was right in the middle of it. And as you say, the pushback was really enormous. And people were coming out of the woodwork criticizing, you know, the science, the government, the pharmaceutical companies. And I think that it caught the powers that be completely off guard.
Really?
I did not expect that it was going to be that big of a push.
Well, their push was very aggressive.
Oh, yeah. They just, they were right in there.
Right.
And when the pushback came, it was, you know, double the aggressiveness that they had shown, and it was everywhere. And they just didn't know what to do. I mean, they were just totally flummoxed. And then, as you say, Cheryl Atkinson published a piece in the fall of 2009 on the CBS News website. She couldn't get the story on the air, by the way, because the powers that be at CBS would not allow that to happen. But she nailed the fact that the Centers for Disease Control, whose only job really was to count cases, I mean, that's it, deaths, cases. And they got all their reports from the state public health department. So really, they just sit in Atlanta with an adding machine. I mean, this is, you know, $1 billion government agency. And they stopped counting cases in America in the summer of 2009. And they told the state public health departments to no longer report numbers of cases, they were going to stop counting because they assumed that it was an epidemic and therefore they didn't really need to know the numbers, which was their job to know the numbers. But anyway, she nailed them completely on that. And she also wrote, and this was really the big one, that coincidentally, the vast majority of assumed swine flu cases, when they had their blood drawn and samples sent to labs for testing, came up negative for swine flu or for any kind of flu, which was the real reason that the CDC stopped counting, because they were totally caught with their pants down.
There was no epidemic.
Visible everywhere.
Right. You know, I think one of the reasons that they didn't anticipate the pushback was they had no idea the extent to which the internet has facilitated communication and organization among the people whose lives and families have been affected by autism.
Yep,
and
that's right.
And those, that group includes an enormous number of highly capable, highly responsible, highly competent professional people. You know, these are people who have assets, they have education, they are, you know, they have relationships, they're respected in their industries and community. And, you know, and that, you know, experience with autism that touched them personally is the thing that shifted them out of the official reality. And so when it comes to health issues, they don't trust the government or the healthcare industry. You know, they trust professionals, healthcare professionals that they know, but they know the whole thing's a lie.
Right.
Because they've lived it.
Connection.
And right.
The government says, oh, we've proved there is no such thing. Well, that's ridiculous. I went over the whole government, quote, proof, and it's just a shell game. It's just words. Matching labels and this and that, and you know, that's another long story we won't get into, but there's an easy way to pretend to prove that something is not the cause of a disease, and the government did exactly that and said, you know, vaccines are exonerated, there's no connection, blah blah blah. These people just wouldn't stand for it, the people
right.
You're talking about, they said
right.
That's absurd. And so they were there, as you say, completely organized, ready to roll. And when the swine flu came down the pike, they saw the similarities and they said, wait a minute here. No.
Right. And since then, what they've been doing, we had a great discussion with Alan Phillips, the attorney who represents a lot of people trying to make sure they aren't forced to take vaccinations. What they've been doing is going state by state and really trying to engineer control of the healthcare professionals on this issue. And of course, Obamacare gives them much more control of the healthcare professionals, because I think one of the things they learned was they couldn't get healthcare professionals to intentionally harm people, you know, on government orders. And there was going to be real pushback. And you notice one of the things, there are two things that kind of rang my bell on Ebola. One, of course, is that if you look at what's going on in the economy, the slow burn is fraying. And it was one of my fears on swine flu that what they were looking for was a cover story for bank closings. If you want to have a bank holiday, it's much easier for financial reasons to say it's a pandemic than it is to say, oh, we're going to have a bank holiday and have bank balance. So that was one of my concerns. But the other one of my concerns is you notice they're very clear to describe their miracle cure as a serum, not a vaccine.
Yes, a serum, not a vaccine.
This is good marketing.
And also, in that vein, they have not called Ebola a pandemic. They've called it a public health emergency, because that's the World Health Organization, because they got burned badly during swine flu, when they suddenly said in the spring of 2009, with 20 cases on the planet, that swine flu was a level 6 pandemic, which was the highest classification of danger that the World Health Organization has. And not only that, but at the same time, they changed their own definition of the word pandemic so that it no longer necessarily implied severe widespread illness and death.
Right.
So when that was exposed, and I was one of the people who exposed that, they backed off from that whole ladder of classification. And so now they're calling this a public health emergency. And they're talking about a serum. And, you know, what I've been writing, I mean, there are various articles. I must have written 10 by now. But look at the countries where they're saying the outbreak is. Look at the conditions in Sierra Leone, in the Republic of Guinea, in Liberia. You know, look at the poverty, the malnutrition, the contaminated water, the toxic chemicals from, for example, a rubber factory, Coca-Cola plant that are seeping into the water, into the ground, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you have the recipe for massive localized epidemics, because any germ that now comes along in that setting is going to kill lots of people.
Right.
The Ebola, could be flu, could be bacteria of some kind that would ordinarily cause a cold somewhere else. But they had to ramp it up with imagery, which is normally the case. So what's the primary image that's being used to sell Ebola? Somebody sitting next to you on a plane suddenly vomits blood all over you. That's the image. Blood pouring from every orifice. You can't escape it. It gets in you and you die. You know, this is like the most vicious germ ever seen on the planet in the history of the world. And you have to run screaming into the night. No cure. That's it. You know, forget the fact that the overwhelming majority of people who are diagnosed with Ebola do not start vomiting blood out of every orifice. They display the symptoms of, you know, immune system collapse.
Right.
And, you know, generalized illness, cough, fever, excessive diarrhea, just general debilitation, those kinds of things.
One of the things I wanted to mention coming into the time when the media started to ramp up the focus on Ebola, we had a couple things going on. You know, there's major oil deposits off of Western Africa. Mm. And in fact, we've seen some of the big majors go in and start to do deals. But we were, you know, you had the empire stuck in the mud all around the world. At the same time, we were coming into the U.S.-Africa Investment Conference in Washington. And you had a lot of major corporate interests who needed to have that meeting be successful. So there's no doubt Africa is a, you know, there is a huge competition going on between the United States and China and the other BRIC nations, you know, sort of the old G7 versus the BRICS. And so, you know, Washington really needed a win. And one of my questions was, okay, after they get what they want, they clearly did, if you look at the deals that U.S. corporations got from West Africa during that, I figured, okay, well, maybe this is just, you know, the U.S. reminding West Africa who's boss and they better do deals, so will it quiet down now? But, of course, it hasn't. It's kept going. And you know, why waste a good public health emergency, John?
Yeah. And I'll give you another economic factor, too, as to why this has persisted. Sierra Leone is the country that has the vast alluvial diamonds. They sit on the beaches. You don't have to drill and go in and, you know, do the big mining operations. It's well known. This is where you find all the diamonds lying around. These are the conflict diamonds, the blood diamonds, which a lot of people don't understand. this has been a major propaganda campaign now for a long time. Oh, are you wearing a conflict diamond? Oh, you know, it's like wearing a fur coat. We're going to throw, you know, paint on you and push you out in front of a taxi, blah, 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 you know, whatever. Well, supposedly these conflict diamonds, you know, according to the propaganda, are being used to finance, quote, armed conflict in these countries, which means that they lead to lots of death. Various revolutionary, rebel, militant groups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Therefore, don't, you know, buy these diamonds. Well, it turns out that De Beers, in their latest incarnation as the diamond syndicate in the world, has for a long time found various ways to keep these diamonds lying on the beaches from getting into the marketplace. Armed forces, et cetera, guarding the beaches and all of that. But they eventually decided that the United Nations would be a great way to do that if they could just relabel the alluvial diamonds, blood diamonds, conflict diamonds. The UN would jump into the whole thing and they would help keeping these diamonds off the market because, in fact, as most people should know by now, there's a vast oversupply of diamonds in the world. There has been since the beginning. And the brilliance of De Beers, or De Beers, has been in limiting the supply of diamonds so that the price stays high. Unlike gold, silver, other precious things, the diamond price is completely and always very, very meticulously controlled within very tight, small limits. So now what do you have in Sierra Leone and in the other two countries? You've got a lockdown. You've got martial law. You've got nobody gets in and nobody gets out. You've got even a further layer of protection now to keep those diamonds from getting out. Yet another reason to continue the propaganda about Ebola, because the West African countries will lock themselves up.
Right.
So that's another factor.
So it's fair to say the possibility of whether real or fake pandemics or public health emergencies, you know, there are many ways to use those for economic warfare to the benefit of the people who control the media on these things. And the risks are, I mean, as we look at what's happening with Ebola, the risks are high that this is one such instance. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No question about it. No question about it.
So here's the question. Our subscribers, the Soleri Report subscribers, what do you do? Because, you know, I am concerned that there are things that can cause health problems. So I'm concerned about environmental pollution. I'm concerned about antibiotics resistance. If you need antibiotics, there's nothing more wonderful. And you know, but we're seeing more and more antibiotic resistance because of all the antibiotics that have been put in the food. So there are real public health things to worry about in this world. How do you tell the difference? And then if they decide to beat the Ebola drumbeats, you know, what do we do? How do we deal with it?
Well, I think there's a broad answer to this and other similar situations, which is the immune system is king.
Right.
The immune system is you, your mind, and your body. It's not just a few T cells here and a few killer cells there. It's the whole shooting match. Everything that a person can do to become more healthy, mind, body, spirit, is going to be protection against whatever comes down the pipeline. Without that, you're not only open to, you know, the latest so-called epidemic, but many other conditions that people, you know, don't want to have. Disease, illness, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the area of natural health has expanded exponentially over the last 70, 80 years to the point where there's a tremendous amount of information available to people as to what they can do in terms of nutrition, in terms of building up their resistance, in terms of strengthening their immune system, in terms of, you know, living a healthier, better life. To me, that's number one priority for people, is to pay attention to that and do something about it. The number two priority is making a decision based on information about what you're going to do with the conventional medical solutions to the latest propaganda campaign.
Suppose, right, because in fact they could do terrible harm to your immune system.
Oh, yeah. The drugs, the antiviral drugs, whether it's this, you know, monoclonal antibody experimental treatment of, you know, MAP Pharmaceuticals in San Diego, which is now the, you know, the magic bullet of the moment, never been tested on humans, never, no clinical trials whatsoever, or the vaccine that suddenly it appears has been waiting in the wings, and they're going to do human trials, they say. They're going to try to rush this into production, it looks like. If they do, you know, those are decisions to be made, because you can count on this. If they rush the production of vaccines and if they make them available to the general public, there's going to be an enormous propaganda campaign to get the vaccine. And you may even once again see states passing laws mandating that this vaccine has to be taken, or you know, tremendous federal encouragement in that direction. In the worst case scenario, it would be that Ebola would be declared a national emergency in America, and some minion of Obama would say, you know, under this situation, you must get the vaccine. I mean, that would be the worst case scenario. I don't foresee that happening, but it's always there as a possibility. I can't rule it out. People need to be prepared to make up their minds about what they're going to do in that case. All I can say, because I don't give medical advice to people, but I say, based on my research, my information, I would never take that drug and I would never take that vaccine, period.
So well, I know how you feel. Okay, well, one of the things I'm going to suggest is that as this unfolds, you know, the other thing I would suggest is if the Ebola drumbeats start to get very loud, you need to assume that there's, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, but there's a 10 or 20% chance that somebody wants this so they can, you know, they have the power to do bank holidays under the cover of it. So I would, you know, make whatever arrangements you need to live through a period like that. You know, because if they do things like, you know, whether real or phony pandemic, then there are going to be real impacts on the financial arrangements and liquidity. There's a lot of different symptoms in the financial system to suggest that they're worried about what's going to happen with liquidity when the Fed taper finishes in the end of October. So I would add that, because this may be as much a financial phenomena as it is a health phenomena. Well, John, the other thing I wanted to suggest is that they keep a watch on your website. If you could just describe your website one more time, sure. Because I think you have great, very timely, quick. You're the best responder to the tapeworms line du jour.
Morefakenews.com. You go there and you see the latest stories, you click on them, that'll take you to my blog. And yes, I do keep watching this, I do keep writing about it. Just, you know, in this case, we're talking about Ebola. I have made comparisons to other pandemics, so-called pandemics and so forth. And I really feel compelled to add this note, because I did write an article about some of these so-called health workers who suddenly came down with horrendous, you know, Ebola when they were previously completely healthy. One thing I learned doing AIDS Inc. was never assume that when they say completely healthy that that's the case. because I analyzed the first, whatever it was, 10 cases of so-called AIDS at UCLA Hospital, got a hold of published medical records of these patients, and just from reading the summaries, knew immediately that these people were far from previously healthy. They had been having tremendous health problems, nothing to do with so-called HIV, et cetera, et cetera. And in the case of the doctors in Ebola, I wrote an article about boiling hazmat suits that these health workers are wearing in high temperatures inside sealed suits, by their own words, as in published accounts, for an hour, boiling temperature, losing 5 liters of fluid from the body in an hour. They come out. They have to be rehydrated for a couple of hours, which it must mean by IV, because if you lose that much and you can even stand up, the only way to rehydrate is through IV. And then they go back in again. And they were upping the sessions from an hour to 2 hours. Does that mean they lose 10 liters of body fluid? I mean, that would kill anybody. And then in addition to that, they're disinfecting themselves with all kinds of toxic chemicals when they come out, these doctors. Chlorine, for example. And one doctor said that when he was inside his hazmat suit, not only was he boiling and losing bodily fluids, but he could intensely smell chlorine, which means that the chlorine was inside the suit, because the suit was completely sealed off from the outside. And so he was getting essentially a form of, you know, gas warfare inside his suit while he was losing all that bodily fluid. I mean, this would give somebody precise symptoms of Ebola, sudden collapse and, you know, just, I mean, off the charts indicators. And that's what these people are doing over there, you see. So I say that as a cautionary note. Don't assume
anything.
Anything.
Right. Well, John, always a pleasure. You have a wonderful day. And we look forward to watching your coverage at nomorefakenews.com.
Thank you so much, Kat.